Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, Washington Post features writer Travis Andrews talks about why he came to love Jeff Goldblum.
So I just asked my colleagues, like, why does everyone love Jeff Goldblum so much 30 years after he was a big star? And I swear, this is going to sound invented for the book, but this is dead true. They just kind of all said in unison, because he's Jeff Goldblum. Like, it should be just self-evident.
Today on the show, Travis Andrews, the author of the new book, Because He's Jeff Goldblum, talks about how he came to love Jeff Goldblum. Stay close.
Hey, my name is Travis Andrews, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you live from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Travis, I don't know if you knew this, but I'll be celebrating my 11-year anniversary in July. How about that?
Wow, congratulations.
I know, it's a lot of shows, right?
That's a lot of shows.
I'm telling you, I've been in podcasting, like I said, basically 11 years, and I have made hundreds of dollars. And it has just really been exciting. Anyway, you guys, I'm so happy that you tuned in once again to Storyworthy, and I sure hope you listened to the show last week with author Ronit Plank. Ronit told a fabulous story. Did you hear her story by any chance, Travis?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, Ronit Plank. It's just all
wild.
It's all so wild, right? Because at one point she's talking about, like, her official story was that she joined a coven. But, you know, back up. You know, what would make somebody do that? Well, if your own mother leaves you to follow a guru cult leader in India when you're only six, well, maybe there's going to be problems in your life.
The natural progression.
Yeah, you might just do some wacky things. And sure enough, Ronit also joined a coven. But she got out of it pretty quick. Anyway, but her book, it's called When She Comes Back, is so strong and so interesting and very, very honest about being left by her mother, not just once, but twice. So her mother went to India, came back. Don't worry, I'm never leaving again. Guess what? Gotta go follow the cult leader. Who they made a whole series on Netflix about that. It was called Wild, Wild Country.
Yeah,
about that guy, the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. And he had a huge colony of people in Oregon, like 6,000 people or something. And anyway, super interesting stuff. So go back, you guys. Listen to Ronit Plank from last week talking about joining a coven, and also her mom. But not today, you guys. Don't go anywhere today, because today I have a really interesting person with me, a journalist and a writer, and he has brought forth the topic, how I came to love Jeff Goldblum. And so I'm very anxious to talk to him about it. He did write a new book called Because He's Jeff Goldblum. And so, you know, it's all kind of about Jeff Goldblum, you know, the whole, we're going to hear all about it, but Travis Andrews has had Jeff Goldblum in his head for, I don't know, 2 decades. I mean, it's a lot of Jeff Goldblum. And all I know is he's from Pittsburgh, and I'm from Pittsburgh as well. So we have that connection. I think from Pittsburgh, there's like me. Listen, I'm like putting myself in the mix. Yeah, sure. Me, Jeff Goldblum, Dennis Miller.
Michael Keaton.
Yeah, one time I was in Pittsburgh downtown in a hotel, and I was in an elevator, and all of a sudden the doors open and Michael Keaton walked in the door, and I was like, huh, that's Batman right there. So interesting. He's so small. I always thought Michael Keaton would be a big guy, but he's not. I bet he's like 5'9". I don't know. Not as big as I thought he would be.
That was like the thing when Batman came out, right? That he was a little scrawny, and people were like, how can this guy be Batman?
No, I didn't know that was a thing. Is that right?
I think so. I think there was like some pushback at the time, like when he was cast originally, and then, you know, he was wonderful in the role, but...
Oh, you're talking about like all the way back Adam West?
No, the Michael Keaton one when, what was that, like 89? Ooh, don't quote me on the date. Yeah.
No. But I think it was in the 80s. Oh, no. I see. So Michael, you think they cast Michael Keaton because he wasn't that, he wasn't like the Christopher Reeves looking guy.
Exactly.
But Superman also turned into Superman. Batman, didn't he remain the same man, but all of a sudden he had on clothes?
He's the least superhero of the superheroes to me. And I know I'll get pushback for that, but you know, his superpower was being rich. That's what he did. He was rich and he angry. You know, that's spare time.
Why do you think? Oh, he wore the outfit because that way he could fly.
Yeah, they fly, and he had like all these little gadgets and things, and he spent all his money training to become some big fighter guy. But you know, no actual powers, which I think is inherent to a superhero, right?
Well, he can fly. That's something.
He can fly, but he has like a machine that does it for him, right?
Then why is he in the bat suit?
I think because there were bats when his parents died. I am not a Batman expert. This is becoming very clear, but I think that it's like a metaphor.
Well, that is interesting. I didn't even have that much information on Batman. So thanks for sharing that, Travis. I am super excited to hear more about your book because I've been reading it. And thank you for this advanced copy. It's a beautiful book, by the way.
Thank you so much.
It really
yeah.
is a lovely cover. And did you get to choose this graphic on the front?
I did. Well, shout out to illustrator Lee Cox, who is a wonderful illustrator. She drew the cover along with about, I think, a dozen illustrations throughout the book. And she's just wonderful. So we collaborated on sort of what the images would be. And then, you know, she just brilliantly drew it. And I think it's beautiful. I think she did a great job.
It really is. It's beautiful. And again, it's called Because He's Jeff Goldblum. And I've met Jeff Goldblum a couple of times. I did. When? He's playing piano. He's a jazz pianist, and he has played at many clubs in Hollywood. This was like 20 years ago, though. This is a while ago. Yeah, and he tried to – he came over in our booth, and I was with my friend Eric, and I think he tried to kind of nudge me toward Eric. Oh, yeah, Eric here. He's a great guy, Christine. You're going to love Eric. This guy, he is smart and he is funny. And Eric's just like, yeah, I am. And Eric and I were just friends. But yeah, it was very Jeff Goldblum. It was a very Jeff Goldblum moment just to, you know, come into our booth and then just, you know, being very, very enigmatic. Is that the word?
Yeah. And try to create this moment of joy. I feel like that's what he likes to go around doing.
Yes, Jeff Goldblum, he's just an angel of a guy. He really, really is. But listen, before we talk about your story and Jeff Goldblum, I wanted to ask you a little bit about being a features writer at the Washington Post. Because I love the Washington Post. Now, unfortunately, I don't subscribe to it, so I only get to read articles very, very quickly before they put up the big blocker. But I do get snippets of the Washington Post, and I love it. Were you thrilled to get that job? And how long have you had that job?
So it was life changing. It was about 5 years ago, almost exactly 5 years ago. 5 years ago, April 4th was my start date. And so for the first 2 years, I worked an overnight shift, which was very different than what I get to do now, which is be a features reporter. So it changed my life in more than one way. I learned how to sleep all day and stay awake all night for the first 2 years and break, you know, big breaking news stories. And then for the past 3 years, I've gotten to write features mostly about pop culture and internet culture figures. And that's just been, it's been a blast. Just you get to be curious about something and really just kind of go down that rabbit hole. And all my editors are super supportive of, you know, crazy ideas where you think of something and say, you know, I need to get to the bottom of this thing. And then just get to go do that. It's a dream
Man.
Job.
I'm so happy for you. It's exciting to hear somebody where they want to be in life. That's tough. That's a tough place to get to. So I'm happy for you. But let me ask you, what does it mean to be the overnight writer? In other words, is that like low man on the totem pole or what's all that about? I mean, in essence, news is always breaking. So you have to have somebody there. We know this.
Yeah. So about, I want to say 6-7 years ago when Marty Baron took over the Washington Post and Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, they decided that they wanted to be a global news operation and they wanted it to be a 24/7 news operation, which means you needed a night team. And the team was six of us, and it's definitely a starting point. Definitely not where you end up at the Post. It's where you begin. But we would work, my editor always liked to joke, we worked the other 9 to 5, so we'd get in there about 9 p.m., work till about 5, 6 a.m., and it was interesting, because you're the low man on the totem pole in one sense, but because any news that happens overnight, anything that breaks, we are the ones to write it, you end up kind of being one of the most visible people in the newsroom, so it's, you know, you give up your sleep schedule and your just life for 2 years, but you also kind of get some visibility, which was nice, and you get to be in the center of really important stories. You know, this is a terrible one, but the Las Vegas massacre that happened on our watch, so we had to cover that from afar, and things like that would kind of occur overnight.
Oh, God. Yeah. And you must get all the night... Those people would get, like, the nightclub shootings and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As it were.
Yep.
I never thought of that. So
that was the dark side, and then the lighter side is we'd do what we call the second day story on the first day. So basically, if something happened during the day that would require kind of a deeper dive or a more interesting historical context or something, we could take that story and spend, you know, the night on it when not a ton of other things are happening, so you can really focus on the writing and the research.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And so then now you're a features writer, and so, okay, do you have days off? Yes, right?
Yes.
Tell me that your days off are?
I work Sunday through Thursday. So my days off are Friday, Saturday.
Okay, so if something happens on Friday or Saturday, and it's obviously not on your watch, do you think, I mean, I guess now you're not doing so much news. You're not really working on news. You're working on stories, which are more evergreen, right?
Yeah, every once in a while, since internet culture tends to be my beat and pop culture, if something, you know, big happens in those spheres, then maybe I'll write a breaking news file. But for the most part, no. So when I'm off, what I try to do and what I think every reporter should do is I try to not look at the news. I try to turn off social media, turn off my phone, just, you know, give myself some headspace for a couple of days, because Sunday through Thursday, I am reading everything, trying to keep up on everything. And you know, I think
that's funny because I was just going to ask you if you were one of those news, you know, those people on the night shift and you're in the news world, when you're off, that was my question. When you're off, let's say you're off that Friday night and something big happens, are you ever like, oh my gosh, I could be covering that. I wish I was covering that. Oh gosh, they would have sent me to wherever, something like that. Or you think
absolutely.
Like, no. So you do want that to happen.
You do want
then.
That. If something big happens and you're off, which is another reason why I try to kind of turn everything off, because otherwise you just kind of get caught up in a cycle, I think, all the time. Because, yeah, if something big happens as a reporter, you always kind of want to be in the middle of it. And you always want to be – I mean, I think one reason why we find these jobs is this natural curiosity and this, you know, something happens, you become curious. You want to dive in. You want to find out what's going on. You want to talk to people involved with it.
So recently I spoke with Ralph Blumenthal. He's another author who works for the New York Times. And he was talking about – way back in the late 60s, how one of the choosiest, or I don't know how you say it, the best jobs, the juiciest jobs you could get was to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That just seems so funny to me. You got to be kidding me. were people that did want to go there.
Oh, absolutely. One thing I've always heard, too, with war correspondents, oftentimes it's younger people who want to go and kind of get in the middle of it and to be honest, raise their profiles. I think a lot of people went to Afghanistan, went to Iraq because it was an opportunity that, you know, if you're older, you have family, maybe it's harder to do, but you're younger, you're hungry, it's, you know, you want to be in the middle of it.
Yeah, I guess so. It's funny. And by the way, you know, Anderson Cooper has been hosting Jeopardy all week, you know, like as one of those stand-in hosts for Jeopardy. I don't know if they're going to figure out then who they choose or whatever, but it's been people like, you know, Katie Couric and Anderson Cooper and then some sports stars. And do you think Anderson Cooper is doing that thinking like, yeah, I'll give everything up and I'll just host Jeopardy? Would he ever want to do that? I mean, not that you would know, but maybe you would know.
I don't know. That's a good question. I actually met Anderson Cooper once in a very strange circumstance. I was in New Orleans, where I'm from, kind of having a night out with some friends. We were down by the park, by the Mississippi River, Waldenburg Park, and it was right after the Deepwater Horizon spill, and Anderson Cooper was reporting. And, you know, we were all a couple beers deep and we see him and we're like, that's Anderson Cooper. And I, to this date, I realize we definitely messed up his broadcast because we all kind of went up and we're like, wait, hey, Anderson Cooper. Anyway, after he finished recording, we went up to him and he was totally gracious. He and I were wearing the same Adidas sneakers, so instant connection. But I was with one of my friends was an engineer, one was a law student, one was a med student, and I told him, you know, I'm about to move to Washington, D.C. and go into journalism. And he said, don't do that. Follow one of your friends in your footsteps. So for all I know, he actually is dying to be the Jeopardy host. It's a lot less pressure.
That is so funny. Oh, yeah, I bet. He does seem like the nicest guy. He really does. Well, listen, I'm super excited to hear your story. But before we get to Travis's story, I wanted to remind you guys that we are playing Story Smash, the storytelling game show, every Friday night live on Facebook and YouTube. It's at 7 p.m. Pacific time. And holy cow, are we having a good time. Travis, I think you would really enjoy my game show, Story Smash, and I think you would make a very good judge.
Oh, it sounds fantastic.
It's so exciting. And every week it's getting better and better. We're like on our 20th week now in a row, you know, in this new platform. We've been playing Story Smash for almost 10 years, but we're usually at the Improv. And now that the Improv's been closed, we've been doing it online. But we are going back to the Improv, so catch us while you can, you guys. Every Friday night, check out StorySmashShow.com for more information. And, of course, follow Story Smash on Instagram, at Story Smash, because that's where all the show action is. Okay? And guess what? You can watch past shows on YouTube as well. Did I tell you that? Yes, I did. That's YouTube. Christine Blackburn. You know who I am. Yes, of course. All right, you guys. He's here right now. Travis Andrews. I'm so excited to meet him because, like I said, I read his book. I'm actually not all the way done, but I'm really enjoying it. It's thicker than I thought. When you write a book about Jeff Goldblum, turns out there could be two volumes. But this is just one. But it is hefty. It's over 200 and... Oh, gosh, it's 306 pages long. This is the, I think I'm going to say it's probably the preeminent guide to Jeff Goldblum. Then you guys can find out more about that at Travis's website, TravisMAndrews.com. But like we said, Travis is a writer and an editor and a features writer for the Washington Post. He's also written for Time, Esquire, GQ, The Atlantic, Mashable, Times Picayune. And I just see The Atlantic. I see Time, Esquire. It just must feel good. Does it feel good?
It feels surreal. I still don't believe it. Sometimes I have to like look back and find my stories and make sure I actually did them. Because you know.
Wow, that is exciting. That is just really exciting that you've just written for so many wonderful publications, and especially because they're all the publications I read. So there you go.
It was crazy too that what you learn at some point. And what they don't teach you in school was the way I got to do a lot of that was just by asking, which I never thought to do. You know, you kind of think of these places as these ivory towers, especially growing up in Louisiana, you know. And then one day I was like, what if I just email and ask? And sure enough, you know.
Bullshit.
Dead serious. You
Tell me the email.
The email, generally the first one is just like, the trick I always tell young journalists is like find the actual editor you want to write for. So know what you want to write. So for GQ, I would write about TV sometimes, and so I found the editor who was editing the TV section, and I reached out and I said, hey, you know, here's some of my writing. I want to write for you. Can I pitch you? And she said, sure. And sure enough, I threw a couple pitches out, and finally she accepted one. And funny story, we are now colleagues, both features writers at the Washington Post. So small, small
world. Wow. That is so interesting. Holy cow. Well, you know, that's so funny because, listen, I don't want to get off topic here, but I've been doing my game show like I just chatted about Story Smash for a while. And I so much want to sell that show. I mean, it's such a perfect show for America. It's just perfect. And I know it would fit just right after Jeopardy or they could go up against Wheel of Fortune or whatever, but I don't know. And I know a lot of people, and people always say to me, but Christine, you know everybody. You know, look at all the people you've had on the show. Can't somebody help you? Everybody always says that. Can't somebody help you? But I don't think you can help somebody. I don't know how it comes together. I mean, so you say, well, pitch the game show. Well, they don't even, when you call, if you call the Game Show Network, they're going to say, who would you like to speak with? And you're going to say, I have a game show. Take my show. You know,
hey, who runs like, things here? I'll talk to that person.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, I heard a comic once say that their mother would say, like, well, NBC, they got a lot of shows. Go over to NBC, knock on that door. You know, so it is, I mean, the fact that you just said you emailed them.
Maybe the trick is emailing Netflix, because it seems like they'll just, you know, take everything. They greenlight anything.
Yeah, honestly. Honestly, maybe I should just tell them. I think you're right. Maybe there's a reason why I'm talking to you today, Travis. You'll get a note from me, and it'll be, guess what, Travis? My show's going up June 1st. It'll be so exciting. Anyway, again, the book, because he's Jeff Goldblum, you've already gotten some terrific praise for it. For instance, from Booklist, Andrew's first book examines the life and work of the irresistible Goldblum with a light, tough, and sardonic sense of humor. It really is funny,
thank
Travis,
you.
And it is so well written.
Thank you.
It really is. I kept thinking, well, how is he going to fill this 300 pages?
I thought that too. But it's I kept thinking that too.
Really, really funny. Publishers Weekly said, Andrews debuts with a gushing biography and cultural consideration of Jeff Goldblum. Those similarly smitten with Goldblum will surely appreciate this lark. And then Library Journal says, Goldblum fans will appreciate this glowing portrait that also analyzes the actor's appeal. I was just thinking about Jeff Goldblum, looked him up. His wife is 30 years younger.
Yes, that seemed to be a through
That's
line
a
there.
That's a lot of decades. I see. Interesting. Well, it is. He was with Gina Davis. He was with Laura Dern. I mean, he's so handsome, and he's just so great. So anyway, I'm anxious to hear about why you chose to put your whole life into him. And you guys can find out more about Travis and follow him on Twitter at Travis M. Andrews.
Yes. I needed to put the M in there because there's a Travis Andrews who produces my Super Sweet 16 over at MTV, and he got all the internet space first, so I needed to.
Gosh darn it. That's hilarious. Follow him, you guys, over on Twitter at Travis S. Andrews. Hang on. Follow him over on Twitter, you guys, at Travis S. Andrews. You guys, follow him over there on Twitter at Travis M. Andrews. Okay, wherever you are, put your hands together for Travis Andrews. Yeah.
Yeah. So one day I am sitting in the newsroom of the Washington Post. At the time, I'm on the pop culture team, which is part of the features section. And Jeff Goldblum is in the news because he's releasing a jazz album. And I don't think at the time I knew he played jazz. I don't think a lot of people did. But my colleagues and I, it was your typical late Friday afternoon when we're kind of all just sitting around, chatting, waiting for the weekend. And at some point I say, I don't get it. Why do people love Jeff Goldblum so much? Like, you know, I'm 33. I grew up with Jurassic Park, Independence Day, some of those big later movies he was in. And I knew him as this big A-list actor from when I was young. But it seemed like he just kept going in people's imagination. He remained as famous, if not more famous, than he was then, now, even though he's not really in big movies. He was in, you know, Wes Anderson's Budapest Hotel, and he was in Thor Ragnarok, which is probably his biggest role since, I don't know, The Lost World, maybe. And so I just asked my colleagues, like, why does everyone love Jeff Goldblum so much 30 years after he was a big star? And I swear, this is going to sound invented for the book, but this is dead true. They just kind of all said in unison, because he's Jeff Goldblum. Like, it should be just self-evident, which is where the title comes from. Because I was like, well, that's both true and not an answer. So my editor, looking for some Friday hits for the Post, was like, why don't you write a piece about this? This is like a funny thing, why don't you kind of chase this down and kind of write a rumination? And so I did. I wrote a piece for the Post and thought it was kind of interesting and kind of thought that was that. A few months pass, and Goldblum's kind of sticking in my craw a little bit. Like, I just keep thinking about it. And I've been revisiting some of his older movies and really kind of starting to fall for him as an actor. Like I said, I always liked him, but I never really thought that much about him. And I also report on internet culture, so I started noticing, you know, he's kind of all around the internet. There's so many memes with him. And in the most, I don't know, blessed day of my life, I guess, I get this call out of nowhere from an agent Laurie Apkemeyer, who I'm so grateful to, who just said, hey, I've been looking for someone to write a book about Jeff Goldblum. I mean, talk about serendipity. I was like, you know, funny you should say that. She had seen my piece, and I was like, I've actually, like, continued thinking about this guy. So when she called, I had, like, the perfect pitch ready, because it's just been in my mind. To this day, I don't know how that happened, and I just pure fate or something. Who knows? So I said, sure. I always wanted to write a book. I never really thought about how that would be. I had written a couple, you know, unpublished novel type things, but you could just kind of make that up, right? Like, this suddenly, next thing I knew, I had a proposal, I had a book deal, and then I was like, oh, I gotta write a book. Like, how do you write a nonfiction book? I truly did not know.
What did she say was her reasoning for wanting a book about him?
She felt exactly the way I felt. She was more familiar with kind of how beloved he was back in the 90s and how it's kept going. But same thing. She thought Goldblum's having a moment for no discernible reason, and people are really interested in this guy, and people love this guy. And I think that's, like, part of the key here. He's not a controversial figure. He is a beloved figure who people just really seem to want to spend time with, who people really... Every person I would tell that I was writing a book about Goldblum would just light up and say, I love Jeff Goldblum. And I think Laurie has just a great, great, great sense of what people are going to love. She repped the writer whose name is escaping me, who wrote Marley and Me. Like, she knows what people will respond to, and she just saw Goldblum kind of having this big moment, and she was looking for someone who could do it in kind of a, you know, funny, I guess, way, someone who kind of some humor to it, some voice. And I always hate talking about myself this way, but I guess she liked what I had written and thought I was the right voice for it. So
she also saw your past. I mean, she sees all of your work. She has read your pop culture articles. I mean, she knows The Atlantic and GQ and Washington Post, right?
Yes, absolutely. And one thing that she had seen in my work and that she was looking for was someone to write it a little different, someone to not write a straight biography, which, you know, there are great biographers out there, but I don't think anyone wants a straight biography of someone like Jeff Goldblum. That's,
yeah, you know, it wouldn't match the cult status that he is. It has to match his vibe, and that's what
exactly.
You do. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. No, that's what I attempted to do, is kind of like, all right, if you're reading about a guy like Jeff Goldblum, who you like because he's handsome, yeah, but also because he's quirky and weird and kind of funny and kind of just fascinating and enigmatic, just unknowable, you know, what do you want from that book? And I think you want the book that, like, tries to bring those qualities forward. And I think Laurie thought I could do it, and hopefully I have. We'll see how people respond. But
well, people are already responding terrifically.
That's true. It's true. It's so embarrassing.
It's not even out yet.
it's very kind.
Wait. Travis, what's embarrassing?
I don't know. When you work at, like, in journalism, you're used to just getting emails telling you how horrible you are all the time. So, like, I think a journalist's natural...
Is that true?
That is true. I'm trying to think of one that's not too dark for your audience, because they get pretty bad.
Oh, no. Okay. Do it. Go dark. I love dark.
Okay. Here we go. This is my favorite story. I was working a morning mix, the overnight shift, and there was this building in somewhere in the Midwest. I want to say Ohio, Oklahoma. It was an office building for that company, the name I can't recall, makes those wicker baskets that are very famous. And the building looks like an enormous basket. It's hilarious looking. I mean, it is
funny.
Truly shaped like a giant basket.
Funny.
And the company was selling this building. Now, who's going to buy a building that's literally a giant basket? And I wrote, like, a fun, funny story about it. My editor wrote the headline, which was just like, you know, company tries to sell America's weirdest building when it's shaped like a basket, something like that. I get an email that just says, hey, you call that basket weird? I hope you don't work at a suicide hotline, because you would tell people that they were weird and they would kill themselves. I hope you can't have children. Fuck you, die. That was the email. over a building. That looks like a basket. Like, so, and like, that's a light email that we get on a non-serious subject. So just imagine when we write about something serious.
No, people, oh my gosh.
Journalist inboxes are probably one of the most just toxic places you can ever,
wow.
ever go.
I didn't realize that. I didn't realize that. Yeah. No, I'm just trying to think. Okay, when I turned 50, I did this photo shoot thing on the back of a Harley naked. Well, sure. You know, who doesn't do that? Well, yeah.
Yeah, that's classic.
Yeah, whatever. And anyway, no, but it went up in the Huffington Post on the front page. Like, this is the new 50 kind of a thing. And it was sexy, but you couldn't see anything. And it's very cool, actually. You can see it at ChristineBlackburn.com. Anyway, but yeah, I got hundreds of letters, hundreds, like probably six or 700 letters. And a lot of them said, they were really half down the middle, actually. A lot of them were said, like, go for it. Good for you. You know, great spirit, fabulous picture. Because it is a really interesting picture because, you know, we're moving and there's a scarf is flying. But the other half all start talking about, well, you know what happened to Isadora Duncan when she wore a scarf in the car and the thing and the Jesus. Thing. And I got that, like, you're lucky you didn't get your face smashed all over the road. You're lucky you didn't get, like, people are just so. So then I actually wrote another article in the Huffington Post about the responses because they were so funny. And, you know, it's been a few years, but I, you know, I took my time, wrote out my very favorite responses, and it's quite humorous. But anyway, so I do hear what you're saying about getting a lot of bad reviews, but that's just towards, you know, that was like for real newspapers that you're talking about.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Okay, so then did you have to go back and forth with that person, Lori, that publisher person, about, you know, chapter after chapter? Did she give you a lot of critiques or any?
So here's like the behind the curtain way it works, because I had no idea going in.
Yeah.
I actually was very glad that Lori really walked me through the process. So I signed with Lori and DeFerry and Company, which is the agency she works for, and Lori asked me to write a proposal. So what a proposal basically is in this instance, you write an outline of the book. You're, in my case, 11 chapters and a couple paragraphs about what each one will be. And then I wrote a sample chapter. That's the meat of it. So I wrote chapter one before we had a deal. And then the rest of the proposal is things like, who am I? Who do I think will buy this book? Here's like some publicity stuff. Just your basic things like that and like an overview of the book as well. But the chapter's really the meat of it. And then she took that and we did some back and forth editing, you know, just like any editor. She would send it back and say, here, 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 I think we should do this and that. And you know, I'd make the edits, etc. And then she took the proposal and she brought it to editors at different publishing houses and tried to sell it. And Jill Schwartzman over at Dutton and Plume, which are imprints of Penguin Random House, is she bought it. And so at that point, Jill then kind of takes over and she became my editor and said, you know, we set a deadline, we signed a contract. And after a while, you know, I send her a book and she did top edits. So basically big stuff. Maybe this chapter should be moved here, things like that. Sent it back. And then I send it back to them. And then it goes through all the copy editing and fact checking and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's just really interesting. And so what do you think your biggest takeaway is, besides Jeff Goldblum's a nice guy? I mean, he's very talented. You think about, seriously, not just that he did a lot of movies. He did huge movies. I mean, box office hits, you know, Big Chill and Independence Day. And then he was the voice for Macintosh, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
The voice for Apple.
And then, yeah, mm-hmm.
Forever.
And then Apartments.com after that.
Apartments.com. Wow. I mean, just keeps going and going. Can you imagine what those contracts look like? How much money he must get?
I try not to, because then I'll just be jealous, and that's a bad thing.
Where does he live? Where does Jeff live?
He's in L.A.
Yeah. He's like 6'4". He's tall.
6'4", yeah.
Yeah.
No, so my biggest takeaway, so it's interesting. One thing I want to explore with the book, and this will sound heady, but I don't think it is in the book. I hope not, but I'm really fascinated in the way the internet has changed culture in so many different ways, and one particular way that I wanted to explore is how the nature of fame and celebrity has changed in, like, the past 40 years, and Goldblum felt to me like a great way to explore that because, as we've said, he, you know, he starts in the 70s and 80s working for these classic historic directors like Robert Altman, and then he becomes an A-lister, and then he stops doing A-list movies, but the internet kind of comes to fruition, and he becomes this internet celebrity. And so I was exploring that, and I think my big takeaway on Goldblum and why people have loved him for so long is that he truly seems to be authentic. And that seems maybe
general. It might seem general, but I don't think it's authentic. I think that he's just truly stable and happy. Like, yes, he just seems to be very, very settled. And I think that's comforting for people to see that. There are just no dark secrets about him, even though he's been married to fabulous women like Gina Davis, Laura Dern. You know, he's had, you know, it's not like he's hidden away. It's not like he's not out there. He's always out there. But everybody has a good word, and I think it's just because he's stable.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. And I think it's because he also doesn't seem to play a game the way so many celebrities do. Right. One thing that I think about a lot is, you know, after Jurassic Park, Independence Day, Lost World, Jurassic Park at the time was the best-selling movie of all time. It had the largest box office gross. He could have done anything. And rather than take that and capitalize on it, he just did what he liked to do. So he kept playing jazz music at small clubs in LA, like where you saw him. Mm-hmm. And he could have taken his fame and turned that into an album right then. And I'm sure it would have been, you know, an incredibly popular album, but he waited 30 years until he was ready. He could have kept taking A-list roles, but he didn't. He kind of took a lot of weird roles over the years, following his own muse that I think would have sunk someone else's career, but you could kind of tell he was just interested in doing new things all the time. And I think people really respond to that, particularly in this attention-grabbing economy that we're in. I think Goldblum feels like someone who is just himself and doing whatever interests him and bringing joy to himself and those around him. And I think people really connect with that. And I think that was my biggest takeaway. It feels like, you know, he would always say he's not a careerist. And that sounds nuts. How can someone who, you know, was in some of the biggest movies of all time not be a careerist? And then you kind of look at his IMDb and you look at the past 30 years and you're like, oh, this guy's not. He could be probably 10 times richer than he is. He could have, you know, been the most famous person in the world, but he chose to just do what he liked.
Yeah, I know. And I really like that laid back quality. But when you're talking about like money, I mean, he could have more money. But how much money does anybody need? And let's just forget the movies and talk about the Apple ads. He was the guy for years, or apartments.com. Like, those kind of contracts are massive. So I guess I'm just saying, like, on one hand, of course he's happy. He does everything he wants, and he's got all the money in the world, and a 30-year-old, you know, a wife 30 years younger and beautiful children. And, you know, of course he's happy. But then a lot of people have all that and are not happy. So it is an enigma, because he just seems really normal.
And one thing that people – I spoke to so many people who worked with him on various movies and things, and one thing that everyone said was he just seems to genuinely love things. He would walk around with whatever book he was reading, and he'd just quote it to people and just light up and want to talk about whatever book he was reading. And, you know, whatever he was into, he would get really excited, and he would learn everyone on a set's name, and he would ask everyone how they're doing and seem genuinely interested. And, you know, who knows if that's somewhat of an act to look like a nice guy, but that's a lot of work to put in.
Well, I gotta tell you, I think part of it could be, you know, he is from Pittsburgh, and it's a very, like, down-to-earth Midwestern kind of town. So maybe part of it is his Western Pennsylvania roots, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe. I think that makes a lot of sense.
And listen, when you meet him, because I know you're going to meet him someday, I'll bet any money, Travis, when you meet Jeff, and then later, everybody's like, oh my God, Travis, how was it? What? And you'll be like, exactly what I thought. He's just Jeff Goldblum, you know. It's just Jeff. Like, I have a feeling he will be just what you want him to be, because I don't think there's any secrets at all.
That's my takeaway as well. You know, the number of people I spoke to, including an ex-fiance who had every, you know, reason to, you know, maybe, you know, drag on the guy, like, nothing bad. And if anything was slightly negative, the response, like, the immediate next sentence was, but, you know, that was an isolated, you know, he's Jeff Gold.
Aww. Yeah, that's fun in a book how you go back and talk to all these directors that he's worked with. You get very close to him. You know, this sort of whole thing, this kind of reminds me of another buddy of mine who was obsessed with Bill Murray. Very similar. I've heard this sort of thing before.
I actually, a guy named Gavin Edwards, this great writer, who wrote a book about Bill Murray, and it was a great mentor to me in this book. I called him up early on, and he kind of... Yeah, shared that kind of, you can get really, really interested in a person and kind of create this picture by talking to everyone around him and everyone who's known him. And in a way, I think you end up understanding the person even more than if you had started by talking to them, if that makes any sense at all. Mm-hmm. Because then you just have, you know, 50, 60 different perspectives of people who knew this person over the years, and it really helps create this picture.
Okay, so one last question, and we got to go. Travis, what's the difference between your preparation in this book and stalking?
Okay, I think the number one thing is he knew the book was being written. So,
okay.
So you know, okay. I think that's a very good question. I think reporting is maybe on the line, but that's the professional way of saying it.
Right. Now, did somebody send him a copy? I know it's not even out yet, but is somebody sending him a copy?
I don't know for sure, but I cannot imagine that they're not, because, you know.
I hope somebody sends it to him, and I'll bet you any money he'll say, Travis, now I don't even have to write my own biography. Thank you, friend. Thank you.
I hope so. Let me ask you this. If someone were to write a book about you, would you want to read it? I've been thinking about this a lot. If someone spoke to 50 people you know, you'd want to read it. I don't know if
absolutely.
I would.
I would. Well, here's why I would. Because I, you know, my audience might know this about me. Because, you know, I've been doing the show for a long time. People kind of, you know, my friends and people that listen a lot know me. That is that I don't really have any regrets. And I never really did anything wrong in my life. I honestly, you know what I mean? Like, I never... When I was 12, I stole a hamster from Woolworths. That's it. Like,
yeah,
you
steal a hamster.
You just put it in the pocket of your members only jacket, Travis. And then it pees on your hand. And so now you have a hamster and all that little, like that bedding that's in the cage and in your pee, and it's all in your members only jacket. That's what you do, Travis. And then you get caught by the mall security cop because he corners you in the back of a Hammond organ store to the beat of a bossa nova.
That is incredible. That is...
It was incredible. No, but that's what I'm saying. Like, I have no skeletons in my closet. Now, what are you saying?
It's
that
not,
you
it's don't not want skeletons that? For me. It's just perception. And, you know, I don't know. I'd be like, oh, what? There's going to be a negative line in there. And I will just focus on that line.
So you're really critical of yourself.
I think so. You know, in some ways, I think that can be good to help you get better at, you know, your craft or whatnot. And certainly sometimes that can cross the line. But, yeah.
Here's the thing. When you're a writer, every word has purpose and everything means something. And if there's a word there that doesn't belong, like just or that or something, then you got to take it out. And if you don't, well, you're wrong.
You know what I mean? That's haunt you.
Yeah. No, I'm serious. So that is, you know, you have to get critical about your work. But that's not you as a person.
Right. Yeah.
You're a great guy that just stalks Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah,
so
no,
what?
It's, on the line of offenses, it's pretty low, right?
I mean, as in the line of stalking celebrities, I think this is a fine one to stalk. Folks, write to Travis M. Anders over there on Twitter. Let him know. Sure, you agree with his stalking, and you will definitely buy his book because he's Jeff Goldblum. It's brand new, you guys. It's out May 4th by Plume. That's a wonderful publisher. Good for you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up. Thank you so much for tuning in. And don't forget to look at Travis's website, travismandrews.com. And like I said, buy that book. It is very, very entertaining. And don't forget to follow me over there on Twitter as well, at Storyworthy, because that's where I like to hang out, Twitter. All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of the very talented Travis Andrews. Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It means the world.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying make it a story worthy.
Thanks for joining us on the Story Worthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.